This is The Blade and Beyond with the DC Dynamic Duo. Learn every detail about life on both ends of the knife. And now, live from Washington, D.C., your hosts, board-certified facial plastic surgeon, Dr. Michael Somanik, and board-certified plastic surgeon, Dr. Troy Pittman.
Okay, everybody, here we are. We are back. We've had a long break. It is Sunday, April 3rd. Welcome to The Blade and Beyond. This is episode 18. I am Dr. Troy Pittman.
And I'm Dr. Michael Somanik. Welcome, everyone.
Where have we been?
A lot of places. Past, 2 weeks ago, we went out to San Francisco for work.
Yeah.
And
I think we can finally talk about why we were in San Francisco.
Yes.
Because it was a secret when we were there.
Yes. So we were looking at a new laser that is specifically designed for acne.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, it has a lot of promise. There's not really anything out there like it. And I mean, the short of it is the technology targets the sebaceous glands, which produce oil, which in turn produce harbor bacteria that produce acne. So they saw some really good results after just several treatments.
Yeah, I mean, this is basically a laser that does what Accutane does.
Yeah, zero downtime, by the way.
Yeah.
I mean, zero. You're pink for like 10 minutes. And you can wear makeup. No damage is being done to the skin.
Yeah, so that's really exciting. And we are excited to get that into our practice and get that into our hands and get that to our patients in the coming weeks.
Yeah, I think they're hoping for a final FDA approval on it. They actually may have already gotten it. So we should be receiving it shortly, and then we can offer that treatment.
Yeah. And then last weekend, we were in Miami to make your dreams come true.
Yes.
We went to Miami Ultra and we saw Kygo.
Yes. We might have been the oldest.
We were definitely the oldest.
But Kygo was amazing. For those of you that don't know, I love Kygo. I listen to his music all the time. When I'm operating, I know the team is like, oh my God, another Kygo song. But they humor me and listen to it and enjoy it with me. So we saw him live. We worked ourselves up pretty close to the stage. I mean, we were certainly not front row. We don't have that much stamina. But we saw him. He did a great performance. Had a couple live performances, which I appreciated.
Joe Jonas came out to sing the new dancing song.
Yeah, which was really good. Randomly, and, 50 Cent.
And 50 Cent came out and sang, hey, shorty,
it's your birthday,
which was fun to see live.
Well, at first I was like, who is that? You looked at me, you're like, I don't know. And then we're like, oh my God, it's 50 Cent. But how random. He sang like three short songs. And then he had another live performance for one of his other songs on his most recent album. So all in all, I thought it was an amazing performance.
And then you went back to see David Guetta with our neighbor. I couldn't handle 2 days.
You gave up on me, but our neighbor, she's like what? Almost 60 years old. She's like, I'll go to Ultra with you. I was like, perfect. So her and I went, we saw David Guetta, had such an amazing time. The weather was gorgeous. Not a cloud in the sky, not a raindrop. Everybody was in a good mood that attended it. Really good energy. So all in all, worth every penny.
Now, you told me when you came back from that third day of Ultra with David Guetta that you thought David Guetta put on a better show than Kygo.
Well, Kygo, I guess you should never repeat that ever again. But yeah, I mean, David Guetta's also been around for a while. And so he's got a lot more songs.
And a lot more mainstream kind of poppy songs.
Right. Yeah. And so his performance did play a lot of his, you know, radio songs. He mixed them up, obviously, but it was a little bit more relatable in that sense and better to dance to.
Yes. So that's where we've been for the last 2 weeks. Everyone has been really supportive. Our listening numbers, I thought they were going to fall off the charts because we were gone for 2 weeks, but the listening numbers are great. So thanks everybody for listening. We're going to start the first segment today by talking about breast implant myths.
Breast implant myths. I have a whole list of them for
okay.
you.
Okay, you just hit me with them.
I'm going to present them and you're going to explain them for us.
Okay.
So, all right, number one, sagging breasts can be improved with implants.
Sometimes. An implant is not the preferred treatment for sagging breasts for the most part.
What if they're just a little saggy?
So breasts with a tiny bit of sagginess, you can put an implant in, you round out the breast, you reinflate the breast, and that's all that's needed. But for saggy breasts, I would say in most patients, they need a lift with or without an implant. Mm. And so the mistake that I see surgeons make a lot of the times is they use a very large implant to take up that extra skin. And what that does is it makes women look like they've gone from saggy breasts to large saggy breasts. Or it looks great right after surgery, but the answer is not to make women, not to make the breast bigger than women ever really wanted their breasts to be. And so I see so many women in our practice who come in and they have these oversized, kind of saggy breasts where they could have been augmented and had the size breasts they wanted if they just had a lift. So
yeah, you see this all the time. I hear you talking about it all the time in the office.
Yeah, it's like 50% of the people that I see have been oversized with implants, and you're going to need a lift sooner or later. So most of the time, a lift is the appropriate surgery with an implant for the first surgery.
Okay, a lift it is. Number two, implants make the breast look fake. Well, I'm sure they can.
Again, it's they can. One of the things that I want to talk about a little bit with this is implant selection. And so there are certain things that we can do to make the breast look more or less fake. One of the things that makes it look fake is when the breast implants are too wide. And so they are squished in the middle and you get that kind of butt crack cleavage. Bras are really meant to create cleavage. Implants are not meant to create cleavage. And so when I am picking implants with patients, the first thing we do is we measure the width of the breast and we come up with their ideal breast footprint, which is kind of like your shoe size. And so if you pick an implant that is too wide, wider than their footprint, it's going to look fake. Conversely, if you pick an implant that's too narrow, it'll make the breast look far apart and almost like stuck on, like mm-hmm. Barbie-like.
And so, that's on thin people, you see that.
Sure. And so once we pick the ideal breast width for the patient, then we talk about low profile, moderate profile, high profile. And that is not only how far the breasts are going to stick out, but also how much fullness you're going to create in the upper pole of the breast. And so, you know, I had a patient last week who was very, very small. She had a very narrow chest wall. And so her breast footprint was very, very narrow. And she wanted a more round, kind of faker look. She wanted to look like she had breast implants. So we chose high profile breast implants. The number that she just fell into was 300. And so she went and she talked to her friends, and her friends said, oh, you're only getting a 300cc implant. That's going to be too small.
Doesn't that drive you crazy?
It does, because it's totally, I don't even really pay attention to the numbers. I pay attention to the geometry of the breast. And so a tiny person, once you get to a certain width of implant and you get to high profile, you cannot go up without making the implant wider. And that's where you're going to get that butt crack cleavage, or the patient's going to look wider at the top. And nobody comes in saying, doctor, I want to look wider.
Right.
No one asks for that. So I did an Instagram post a couple of weeks ago where I had four women who all had the exact same size implants. But when you look at the four pictures, they look totally different. And so you can't go to your girlfriend and say, I'm getting a 400cc implant. What do you have? Unless you have the exact same body type. And so, and the exact same amount of sag to your breasts and things like that. So yes, they can look fake if they're done incorrectly. Sometimes patients want to look fake.
We see a lot more of that in Miami.
Exactly.
That's for sure.
Okay, next.
Implants make breastfeeding impossible.
That is not true. So when we put implants in, particularly under the muscle, we're not disrupting any of the breast glands. And so unless you're using an insanely large implant that's going to put a lot of pressure on the breast gland and cause it to atrophy over time, women should be able to breastfeed. Now, remember, most women who are getting implants have small breasts. And so we don't know, unless they've already breastfed, we don't know how much milk they're going to produce. So when I see a 20-year-old who has tiny natural breasts, we don't really know how much those breasts are going to produce at baseline. So she may get an augmentation and not have a lot going on with milk production, but it's not the implants, it's just her own anatomy.
What about above the muscle?
So above the muscle is a little bit trickier, but I can tell you that it shouldn't preclude people from breastfeeding because you're still going beneath the breast gland. So you're not disrupting the ducts and the ductal units that are making and supplying milk to the nipple.
Unless it's a huge implant that thins the skin out.
Right. And so that's the one thing that we caution women about all the time with huge implants, because with a big implant, just like any other part of the body, when you stretch the tissue, the gland is going to thin out. And so that can actually cause destruction to some of the breast glands.
Did you like how I knew that fact?
Yeah, I'm impressed. I thought you were going to say, it's just like when you put a chin implant in or something.
No, that's coming on myth number seven. Hold on. Okay. Surgery scars will be unsightly.
Most of the time. So
kind of a deceptive statement.
Yeah, I mean, I put all of the incisions in the fold. So I don't do any periareolar incision where it goes around the areola, because that can cause issues long term. There are increased rates of infection, increased rates of capsular contracture. So I don't really like that operation. So I make a tiny incision in the fold. And unless you're right there looking at the fold, you don't even see that incision. And I tell women that anybody who's close enough to see the little inframammary fold incision doesn't care that you have one there.
Yeah, that's a good one. This next one is probably really important. Nipple sensation will disappear after surgery. I can imagine that can be devastating.
Right, so we see a lot more sensitivity issues when implants are put in through a periareolar incision, because you kind of are going underneath the nipple, and that can disrupt the nerve that supplies the nipple, which kind of runs through the breast. However, going under the breast through an inframammary incision,
bypassing it,
we're really not doing anything to the nerves that supply the nipple. One of those things, again, if you stretch the breast, though, the nipples can become less sensitive. They can become more sensitive. This all is an issue really right after surgery. I have women say, my breasts feel swollen, my nipples feel like they're burning. And that's just stretching of the nerves at baseline.
Early on.
And yeah, and so that resolves within 4 to 6 weeks. But long-term loss of nipple sensation is pretty unusual with a breast implant that's been put in through the inframammary fold.
Got it. So that's just implant stuff. It's not lift
conversation.
That's right. Totally separate myth, maybe. I hesitate to tell you this one because it's like its own like half hour
podcast. You know
podcast.
I'm going
to
go on a tirade. You keep looking at the clock.
Well,
are you worried that my segment's going to go longer today?
I'm just wondering,
well, we have
given
a lot
some
to
of these,
about.
You're very passionate about them and you know we only have a limited time. So, all right, here it is, everyone. Brace yourself. Breast implants are unsafe. Myth?
Well, it is a myth. As far as unsafe goes. And so I will spare everyone the soapbox lecture. You can go back and look at breast implant illness, which was a previous episode of our podcast. But let's just talk about really briefly safety of breast implants.
Yes.
Breast implants have been the most studied medical device in the history of the FDA. And they're vetted. And so we have really good long-term data on
years
all
of data.
Our silicone breast implants. There was a moratorium on breast implants from 1994 to 2006. On silicone. Did I say saline?
No, you just said breast implants.
Yeah, there was a moratorium on silicone breast implants from 1994 to 2006. During that time, there were so many high-level studies to show that implants were safe. And so in 2006, when the implants came back on the market, we had the fourth generation implants. And now we're at fifth generation kind of gummy bear cohesive implants. And I do think that the implant technology has evolved to where the implants that we have now are probably the safest implants that we've ever had on the market. Yes, breast implants can rupture, but a breast implant rupture alone is not an unsafe situation. It's just a situation that needs to be addressed.
Mm-hmm.
And for patients who are concerned about silicone implants, we do have saline implants, and the Ideal implant is a new type of saline implant that actually has internal baffles, almost like a waveless waterbed. And so the rupture rate
sounds comfortable.
Well, the rupture rate of the Ideal implant is lower than the traditional saline implants. You don't have a lot of that movement of saline, so it's not that waterbed feel. So that's great technology. Certainly in my practice, I use silicone implants predominantly. Mm-hmm. But for women who are concerned about that, the reason I really like the Ideal implant as an option is women who are concerned about a silent rupture, or they're saying, what if I'm walking down the street and my implant's ruptured and I don't know it? With a saline implant, when it deflates, it's like a flat tire. And so there are no silent ruptures. If your implant ruptures, you know it immediately.
Oh, it's like a deflated balloon.
Yeah. So, you know, we're very, we're all about giving women a lot of options with this. But to say that breast implants are unsafe, untrue, that's a myth.
Okay. Very good. I think you did a nice, concise summary.
We did them all? We did all eight of them?
No. I was just
saying. You're cutting me off.
No, I was just saying on breast implants are unsafe. I think you did a nice, concise delivery of that.
I'm holding back today.
Okay. Next one is implants need to be replaced every few years.
So we used to tell women, your implants are going to last about 10 years. And that's because when we look at the long-term, the 10-year data for the fourth generation implants, particularly Mentor implants that are manufactured by Johnson & Johnson, those implants have about a 24% rupture rate at 10 years.
That's frightening.
And so one in four women would have a rupture.
Right.
And so we would kind of reflexively tell women about every 10 years, you're probably going to have your implants replaced. Looking at the new cohesive gummy bear implants, the rupture rate at 10 years is only 8%. And so only about 1 in 10 or less than really 1 in 10 women would have a rupture at 10 years. So I tell patients now, it is much more common if you're getting implants as a young person that you're going to go through life, gravity is going to take hold of your breasts, children are going to destroy your breasts with breastfeeding. It's much more common that you're going to come back and you're going to need to have something done with the soft tissues than it is that you're going to come back with an implant rupture. If everything is going well with the soft tissues and we do imaging, so high resolution ultrasound, MRI, to see that there is no rupture, there's no reason to change the implants if they're not causing a problem.
Even 20 years later?
Even 20 years later.
Yeah, I know. I have a few patients that are like, oh, I think I'm going to see Dr. Pittman. I have like my implants are like 22 years old. They're not giving me any problems. I just want to see if I need to do something. So it's always interesting to see those women that are, you know, not having issues, doing just fine.
So the 20-year-old breast implant patient, what I would do is if they like their breasts and they're not having any issues, I'd send them for a high-resolution ultrasound or an MRI just to make sure that there isn't a rupture. Because silent ruptures are a real thing. But no one says you have to replace them. But they are medical devices, and they do need to come out. You shouldn't get an implant thinking that you're going to have the implant for the rest of your life.
Well, I think you knew this was coming. But in contrast to breast implants, chin implants actually never need to be replaced.
Well, because they're a solid block and don't rupture.
I just want to inform everyone about that in case they were wondering from that statement of the
breast implants. In case you're worried about a chin implant rupture?
That's right.
Oh, boy.
Not just replacing it. So, okay, now we are going to go to...
In the news.
Okay, in the news this week, we actually have a few things that are interesting about our little girls, Sophie and Piper. Dogs, that is.
Oh,
So we did their DNA about a month ago, 2 months ago, and it takes a while to get it back. And we finally just got it back. So a little background on them. They are adopted from a foster home in Tennessee. They were the only two in their litter because their mother was very young when she was found pregnant.
And she was abandoned in a park.
And she was, but the mom got adopted. So there's a very happy story to that as well. So we took both girls who... You know, we saw the mom. They kind of look like a little bit of Chihuahua, a little bit of Yorkie, but the two of them look very different, where Sophie looks kind of like a mini pincher and Piper looks more like a terrier. So we were like, we got to get their DNA checked.
And if you're interested, you can follow them on Instagram at DC Dynamic Dogs. They have their own Instagram page.
Living their best life. So okay. Tell everyone about DNA.
So we did a little cheek swab. We sent their DNA off, and it came back that we always thought that they were half Yorkie, half Chihuahua, but they're actually pretty much half Yorkie, 1/4 Chihuahua, and 1/4 miniature pincher.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have what's called super mutt DNA, which is like little fragments of DNA.
Like healthy DNA.
And Piper, who is our little more spirited dog, has a pit bull in her.
And she's 10 pounds, everyone. So
but that explains why she's a beast.
Yeah, she is a beast. A very friendly beast, but she is on a mission.
Yeah, and in life. But it also tells you potential health problems based on their chromosomes.
Which I wish we didn't do, because I don't really want to know.
But they got a clean bill of health. The only thing they said was they could have degenerative disc disease, but little dogs are at increased risk of having that all the time. So that was fun.
So that's their DNA. We're very excited. And they are sisters from their DNA test. Yeah. We have confirmation of that.
And they're here in our home studio with us today. And they are signaling that they want you to follow them on Instagram at DC Dynamic Dogs.
Yeah, Sophie is laying in my lap currently. So the other thing is, and I hesitate to bring this up, but, you know, the performance, I'm going to call it a performance,
around the world
at the Oscars last weekend. You know, it's been an interesting week with how the Academy has been addressing this. First, they were like, we asked him to leave. He didn't. And then it was like, we really didn't ask him to leave.
He slapped
Chris Rock. And then now he's resigned from the Academy because probably he was going to get thrown out anyway.
Yeah.
But I feel like there's like something else that needs to happen with this to let everyone know this is not an acceptable thing. Can you imagine if they're like, oh, well, he only had to resign. Like, you can go to the award show and slap the presenter if they offend you.
What's crazy is you can get thrown out of a bar. I mean, if you slap someone in a restaurant or a bar, you would get thrown out. So, I mean, an international audience, you slap someone, you should be thrown out.
Those people that were doing like voiceovers on like from China, it's actually comical to listen to them trying to voice over and create like, you know, translate basically.
Yeah.
Because when Will Smith was like screaming from the audience, the interpreter was like, say anything.
Yeah, are we going to interpret the F word?
But anyway, the reason why we're even going into this,
it gives us the opportunity to raise awareness on alopecia.
Not on Will Smith, but his wife's alopecia, which, I mean, let's be honest, I'm not sure how many people knew she had alopecia. She's not that public of a figure or relevant. Don't come for me.
Well, she had talked about having alopecia, but the way that it's presented with Will Smith is she has this horrible health condition that he was protecting her from. And alopecia, obviously, if you have alopecia, it is something that's disturbing, but it's not... It's not a serious debilitating disease.
Well, I totally disagree with you on that. I think it can be absolutely debilitating. Imagine, especially women who are very recognized for their femininity with hair a lot of the time, when they start losing their hair, they start losing a part of their identity, and it can be debilitating. And it can be equally debilitating for men.
Well, I was going to say, I think that you can't just say it's for women.
No, I'm not.
End up wearing wigs. It's harder for men who are balding.
But it's more socially acceptable for a man to go bald than a woman to go bald. So, I mean, the whole reason we decided to go into this was it was a great opportunity to speak about alopecia. And I'm not sure we're going to talk and break everything down today, because it actually is a pretty extensive conversation to have. But, you know, there's various types of alopecia out there. The most common is what's called androgenetic alopecia, which affects men and women, quite frankly, equally, and is likely due to basically a hypersensitivity to a breakdown product of testosterone is like the best way to describe it. And it basically miniaturizes your hair follicles. So over time, you start feeling your hair thinning, you start losing your hair, and that just keeps going over and over and over again. Now, I'll go more into that in a second because I want to talk about the hair cycle. But from what I can gather, and I haven't listened to any of Jada Pinkett Smith's podcasts or anything, so I have no idea what type of alopecia she's actually diagnosed with. But it looks like she has what's called alopecia areata, which is a patchy hair loss, because one of the pictures I saw looked like she had like two bald spots on the crown of her scalp.
Where she was showing, I saw an interview where she was showing that.
Yeah, so that looks like alopecia areata.
Is an autoimmune disease.
Yes, and there is sadly no cure for it.
So the antibodies that you're making attack the hair follicle.
Yeah.
And target them as foreign. So your immune system basically attacks the hair follicle to destroy it.
But in a patchy manner, which right. is strange to me. But either way, I mean, a lot of the times doctors need to put patients on high-dose corticosteroids, maybe do injections into the scalp. There's some other immune modulators that are being experimented and trialed currently for it. But there is sadly no cure. So I think what she elected to do, and I think she looks quite beautiful with her kind of short shaved head, is shaved her head and kept her hair very, very, very short.
She looks great.
Yeah, she does. So androgenetic alopecia, that's the most common one. That's the most common type of patient that I see for my patients. Come in with just a very progressively thinning hair in general. So they see progressive loss of their hair.
Excuse the dog barking in the background.
So they have progressive thinning and subsequent loss of their hair. And there's certain things that can cause it. Most commonly, there's vitamin deficiencies. So vitamin D is a big one. Your vitamin C.
Thyroid,
you know, so there's hormonal. Mm-hmm. Testing your thyroid function is a real big one. So for people that are hypo or hyperthyroid, that can contribute to hair loss. So when someone comes to see me for this, I always make sure they have recent labs on, number one, their vitamin D level, as well as a thyroid panel to determine if one of those are a common cause. If they are not, it just happens to be that hormonal androgenetic alopecia. And so there's certain things that you can do to at least maintain what you have and then potentially increase growth. Mm-hmm. One of the things, particularly for men, is I think propecia is almost something that most men that are looking to address hair restoration need to be on, because it will slow down the follicular loss of the hair and really kind of pause a lot of what's going on and can be the difference from developing a bald spot or not.
Mm-hmm.
So I think when someone's coming in for some type of treatment in the office, I encourage them to go on propecia. Now, there's just some males that elect to not go on it based on the potential for sexual side effects that can happen. And that's the main one. So for those that elect not to, that's fine. But the other popular thing that we do in the office is called PRP, or platelet-rich plasma, which is essentially harvesting and isolating the integral growth factors that really can help stimulate the hair follicles within the scalp. Now, it can help maintain, similar to what propecia is doing. Obviously, the mechanism of action is a little bit different, but it can maintain what you have. And I do see regrowth in a lot of patients that yep. go on it, particularly along the hairline, the temple region, the vertex of the scalp are some of the more common areas. It isn't something that's a one and done, unfortunately. It is something you need to get into a maintenance mindset, coming in every 4 to 6 weeks for about 3 to 4 treatment sessions. We reassess, see how you're doing. And then some patients love it so much, they get another session
yep.
and they keep coming. Others are like, okay, I feel pretty good about this. I'm going to come in every 6 months or so and get a booster injection to the scalp. I always put you on some form of supplement. So there's 2 supplements on the market that I think are really good for hair regrowth or just hair maintenance or an overall hair health. Viviscal is one of them. And then the other is Nutrafol, which has a little bit more of an extensive line. But I think that if you have access to only one of them, they're both solid products for supplementation.
One of the things that I was just thinking about that I guess I never thought about, women can't take propecia.
I know somebody asked me, a pretty well-known dermatologist asked me at one of the conferences I was at recently, and he has started to consider propecia for women, because I don't think, and I'm not an endocrinologist, so that's why I haven't started doing this or explored it, but I don't think there's any contraindication for a woman to not take it. So, because what it's doing is it's blocking that byproduct of testosterone that's causing miniaturization of the hair follicles. So, yeah, I think there's some research. There probably is some research being done with Propecia and females to see. Because Rogaine, unfortunately, is just one of those things that men and women can take. Women really don't see huge differences with Rogaine. And men, you know, see kind of mixed results with it. So that's why I'm never jumping to recommend that. I really favor kind of topical growth factors instead of Rogaine. So that's why we give a specific growth factor serum to apply to the scalp with the hair restoration treatments. So I do want to just briefly go over, for those who are wondering, like, well, why don't these injections work instantly, like in 4 to 6 weeks? And that really comes down to the hair cycle. Now, the hair growth cycle has sort of three stages. The first one's called anagen, and that's basically like the growing phase. Now, that is such a variable phase that it can last from 2 to 7 years. So literally a hair follicle can continue to grow for that amount of time. Now, there's a finite amount of time that this poor follicle can continue to produce hair. So what happens is what's called catagen, which is your regression phase. And that's where the hair follicle starts shrinking, which subsequently leads to that a thinner piece of hair. So it's not your imagination if you're like, over the years, my hair has thinned. Not so much in quantity, but quality.
Right. And the strand is thinner.
The strand gets thinner. So during that catagen phase, the follicle continues to shrink. And then you get what's called telogen, where the hair follicle has shed. The follicle is like shut down and goes through this resting phase, which is no hair in that area. So,
but what you really want is you wanted to go through the resting phase and you want to wake up again.
Right, real fast. And so sometimes that's where PRP and some other things come into play, because
it just shortens that resting phase.
Yeah, you're potentially like, think of it as almost adding fertilizer to the scalp and those hair follicles. And whether or not that's a good analogy, I do think of it that way, because you're kind of throwing growth factors that at these follicles that have receptors to these growth factors and hopefully stimulating a little bit of caffeination to them.
Yeah. And I think that it's important to note, you know, someone who comes in who's completely bald and they've been bald for 5 years, doing PRP on them is not going to work, because their follicles are gone. I mean, the hair follicles are in a permanent resting state, and you can't bring dead things back to life with PRP.
Yeah. That's why sometimes I get people that have pretty extensive hair loss, and you know, they're like focusing on their temples saying, can PRP make my hair grow back here? And I say no.
Yeah.
I mean, there's hair transplant for that, and there's some good transplant surgeons, at least for us on the East Coast, so just a few that I recommend.
So for anybody, just to kind of sum things up, so patient is noticing progressive thinning of their hair. It's looking like the light is shining through their hair a little bit more. What should they do?
They should probably get their labs checked, number one. And then they really need to see somebody that specializes in hair that can go over a pretty thorough history with them, take a look at the scalp, see if it is patchy. Because if it is patchy, that's a little bit of a different treatment than if it's just diffuse thinning. And during that history, we really try and get through, like, how long has this been going on? Is this acute? Because there's another thing, another type of shedding that can happen with alopecia, that you like lose tons of hair.
Like telogen effluvium.
Yeah, telogen, yeah.
Which so, a lot of times people with anesthesia can get that.
Oh yeah, stress, anesthesia, there's a couple reasons for that. But, and then come up with a treatment plan with that provider who, after getting a good history and being satisfied with the labs, should be able to guide you into what's the most appropriate treatment moving forward.
Perfect. Well, see, something good came out of the Oscars.
Yes.
We are raising awareness on alopecia.
All
right, everybody, we are out of time. We went to 35 minutes, and that was probably my fault from the breast implants. But we have not been on the air for 3 weeks, so we had a lot to talk about.
But we broke down so many breast myths, which always makes me happy.
Of course they do. Okay, so have a good week. We'll be back next Sunday. Talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
That's a wrap. Remember to share the podcast with your friends. Follow the docs on Instagram at SomnicMD, at Dr. Troy Pittman, and at DC Dynamic Duo. To learn more about the procedures discussed on today's podcast, visit www.SominicPittmanMD.com. That's www.SominicPittmanMD.com.